I would definitely put it in the top 10.
It's so good.
A lot more thought has gone into the story.
I think it's awesome.
This is a spy movie disguised as a superhero movie.
There's such clear-cut good and bad.
It's definitely got some horrific elements.
Well, once we go there, you're just going to throw physics out the window.
That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
This is like the Fast Times at Ridgemont High of the fantasy world. Yep. Wow. That was something else. Now, kids, your homework tonight is to go home and watch this on television.
At that point in the script, you're actually rooting for her.
And I am just giggling maniacally through the whole thing.
When slashers came home.
I love that they just throw you in there and say, okay, find your way out. A lot of people don't like horror movies.
It's a coming of age, not a horror movie.
But I still love it because it's a slice of life, and I'm okay with that. Tim really wants to like this movie.
I loved the production design.
I wanted more from this movie.
Your reality is not what you think it is.
Oh my God, am I destroying our podcast?
You must seize the only specimen of the Marifaza plant in England. That flower is the only known antidote for werewolfery.
A very interesting folktale. But of no value to the police.
I warn you, sir, unless you secure this plant, there'll be an epidemic that will turn London into a shambles.
When my experiments are completed, I will show their results to the entire world, not before.
Remember this, Dr. Glendon. The werewolf instinctively seeks to kill the thing it loves best.
You brought this on me. That night, in Tibet.
Sorry, I can't share this with you.
La 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 la. Isn't this fun? Lovely stroll on the moors.
Did you hear that?
I heard that.
What is it?
You think it's a dog?
Nice doggy. Good boy.
What happened to them?
Well, the police report said they were attacked by an escaped lunatic.
A wolf. My friend Jack was just here. Told me that I will become a monster in 2 days.
Your dead friend, Jack.
Yes.
Gotta believe me, David.
Believe what? You're one of the undead, and I'm a werewolf.
Tomorrow night's the full moon. You're gonna change.
A what?
You'll become...
I know. A monster.
Hello and welcome out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast where two guys get together. We talk about horror movies, science fiction movies, key elements of those particular movies, and then things that that movie might have influenced going forward. All about influences, that hence the keys in the title. If you're new to us, we would love to welcome you and say, hey, thank you for being here. Click down below and subscribe and like and do all those things so we can get in touch with you and let us know how you heard about us. We'd love to research some marketing and find out how that works. If you are returning to us, welcome back. We're glad to have you. It'll probably be more of the same. We're totally unscripted. We just say whatever happens, and whatever happens, happens. But my name is David, here with my good friend Tim. Tim, welcome to Johnny. How you doing?
Hey there. You know, we do tend to yammer on a bit.
We do.
With being unscripted, and that's a good thing, I think. Anyway, mm-hmm. I enjoy doing this, and I think some people out there are definitely listening to us or watching us on YouTube. Yeah. What have I been doing? We usually break the ice with a little bit of conversation starter. That's redundant. Anyway, what have I done in my genre week? Well, yes. I watched a movie that has been on my list for a while just because it got high ratings. It was an independent horror movie, and I'd never heard of it. It's called Ennismen. I think that's how you pronounced it. Ennismen.
Ennismen. Okay.
The reason it's pronounced that way is it's Scottish or Irish. Ennis is, I don't know if that's a Scottish or Irish word. I think I can't remember where it takes place. It's a very strange movie. Very much like Ty West, they painstakingly create what looks like a movie made in 1973 when it was actually made in 2022.
Okay.
It was written and directed by Mark Jenkin. He's British and won the Outstanding Debut BAFTA in 2020 for a film called Bait, which I had never heard of.
Okay.
It's really not far from being just a solo performance by Mary Woodvine, the lead actress, with occasional appearance / hallucinations of a couple of other characters. She is on an island by herself. Well, let me just give you a synopsis. Ennismen is a 2023 Cornish folk horror film about a lone wildlife volunteer on a remote island who experiences a descent into a surreal and potentially nightmarish reality. The film, which translates to Stone Island in Cornish, is known for its repetitive daily routines, minimal dialogue, and a haunting, time-bending atmosphere that blurs the line between the volunteer's sanity, the island's history, and supernatural events. It's a mood-driven film that offers no definitive answers, instead creates a disorienting experience for the viewer through its aesthetic and ambiguous narrative.
Okay.
It sounds better than it is, trust me.
Okay.
It only gets 79% on Rotten Tomatoes with 102 reviews. I would knock that down to a 70. It is a slow burn, but it never really pays off. You know, a slow burn needs to pay off.
Yeah.
Like The Witch.
If you're going there, you better be there. Yeah.
Right. It's trippy. It looks and feels a lot like The Wicker Man, which is a 1973 movie, but only with one character. But overall, it's a slog. It kind of feels like a student film because it's very repetitive. I would not recommend it, but I was shocked when I realized it was made in 2022. I thought it was really made in 1971.
Wow. Well, remind me again, how did you originally get hooked on it?
It was just on a list of good horror movies to watch, and then I checked on Rotten Tomatoes, and it ranked in the 70s. So I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. So
okay.
That's it, basically. I keep a running list, and it was on my list, and I just decided to watch it. Okay. And there is a loose connection as far as segues to one of the films we're covering today. So, and I'll get to that when we do the film.
Okay. Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Good. I'll be looking forward to it. Mm-hmm. I did something kind of weird, twisted, and unusual, and I think you'll like it. And hopefully you'll join me in this quest sort of thing. A friend of mine turned me on to The Amazing Digital Circus. Have you heard of this?
No.
This is, well, let me read to you about it and see. It is created, here's the whole thing from Wiki. It is an Australian adult, independent, animated web series created, written, and directed by Gooseworks. That's the person, and I think she's female, that created all this, but she goes by the moniker Gooseworks. It's produced by Glitch Productions. The series follows a group of humans trapped inside a circus-themed virtual reality game where they are overseen by a very erratic artificial intelligence while coping with personal traumas and psychological tendencies. Okay. The reason I got hooked on it was this friend of mine said, "Have you ever read I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, of course." And she goes, "Well, supposedly that's the inspiration for this cartoon series that's gotten huge hits right now." And I went, okay, cool. Anyway, the first pilot premiered in 22. And within 3 hours of the premiere, it had over 1 million views. And since then, they do like maybe 2 episodes of this series a year. They're up to the 7th episode, and supposedly it's going to be a limited season. It's going to be one season only, and it's 9 episodes, and then they're done. They're telling the story. It is really interesting, Tim. It is
What's
scary.
It
I think you can find it now. Just you can YouTube it, of course, but I think it's on Netflix now, has picked it up.
But, they'll turn it into something else, just like Black Mirror.
But the easiest thing is to, no, they're not producing it. They're just showing it. They're not involved with it financially, yet, as far as I understand. Yet. But I would suggest you YouTube it. That'd be the easiest way to do it. It's very intriguing and very interesting. And if you know the short story, if you've read I Have No Mouth,
right,
you can see the definite, even character parallels of who's playing who with the trauma that they have.
Are they crediting Harlan Ellison?
Yeah, Harlan Ellison is credited a couple of times.
If he was alive, he would be after them.
Like I said, this Gooseworks person has said, oh, it is totally my version of Ellison's work. So you need to watch it. I think you
What's
would be
it called
very
again?
Intrigued by it. It's called The Amazing Digital Circus. 7 episodes, some funny, buffoony stuff, but also some really, really psychological trauma areas.
If it's on Netflix, it's probably not on YouTube anymore.
I'm pretty sure it's still on YouTube.
Okay. Well, I'll check it out.
You might be able to look and see. And it may not be Netflix. I misspoke. It may not be Netflix that is distributing it. It may still be on YouTube. Because okay. I know it's Australian produced and they're very Glitch Entertainment wants to control the rights and keep it and everything else. But Gooseworks said that they originally pitched it to Glitch back in the 90s, but they didn't have the animation capability of doing it the way they wanted to do it. So they waited. And it took, till 22 to do it. So, it's really interesting and definitely so Harlan all the way through it. It feels like Harlan would love this, would go, yeah, that's what I meant. It's not as, so far, like I said, they're about to do, about to release the penultimate episode sort of thing. But it's not as cruel as I Have No Mouth, but it's pretty psychologically scarring like that one was.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So, and it anthropomorphizes a lot of these characters. These characters are very weird the way they're channeled or the way they're animated and turned.
Interesting.
These humans. So, yeah.
Wow. Well, I really have no segue from that or mine, except in the second film that we're covering, I will mention something that relates to them. Today, we're doing a double feature.
We are.
And it is probably a long overdue double feature because we've only done one other werewolf movie that I can think of, and that is The Wolfman from 1941. Today we're doing a double feature of an even earlier film, Werewolf of London, as well as its somewhat comedic counterpart, An American Werewolf in London, which came out in 1981. I guess we'll start with, obviously with that video filter. We're going to start with Werewolf of London.
Yeah.
And go all black and white. A brief synopsis is this starts with jumping around. It starts with a botanist in Tibet looking for a rare plant that only grows in a certain part of Tibet, and he is attacked by a humanoid-type creature and bitten. They actually show him get bitten. I do remember that. Mm-hmm. And he comes back to London with his prize plant, and, of course, he is now a werewolf. This plant, supposedly, he is told by Dr. Yogami. I'm trying to think of their names. The main guy is Dr. Glendon. The other doctor is Dr. Yogami. Yogami tells him that this plant has the ability to temporarily subdue lycanthropy in people.
Yes.
And I don't think he buys it at first until he himself starts to turn into a werewolf, then pricks one of the blossoms and gets it on him, and the hair disappears off his hand.
Mm-hmm.
I do find it a little interesting that they're in hot pursuit of this temporary cure when basically there's still a werewolf running around and that plant's not going to last.
Right.
And Yogami ends up stealing two of the blossoms from the plant. So Glendon ends up killing some people as a werewolf. And then eventually he is shot at the end and dies and basically thanks them for putting him out of his misery. I guess I don't know if I can think of a better way of explaining that. Did I leave anything out pertinent?
No, other than the fact that was this the first werewolf movie?
It's the first feature length werewolf movie.
Okay. Because that's kind of a big key for this is it's the first.
It is. It is not the first, obviously, in history as far as folklore and stories and stuff. And apparently there were short films maybe that preceded it, maybe short silent films. But this is the first full-length talking werewolf movie.
I also saw one review or whatever that said that even based on folklore or whatever, this was the first time they actually show the – or the first time the werewolf is not shown as a total beast. In other words, there's a conscious guilt factor in the person afflicted rather than it being, oh, it's a childhood folktale scary story where in the full moon you'll turn into a monster.
Right. And there's been all of those elements that you're talking about that we know mainly from the Wolfman of 1941. They all have origins in the folklore, just different folklore from different areas of the world.
Right.
And yeah. But this is the first movie to incorporate some of that in there, including the sympathy for the main character. I mentioned it's the first feature-length one. There was a movie called The Werewolf in 1913 that was 18 minutes long, but it's now considered lost, and all copies were destroyed in a warehouse fire.
Well, so, makes sense.
But there is record of it. It's on IMDb, actually.
Okay.
It was directed by Stuart Walker. He was an early Paramount talkie director.
Okay.
When films started doing sound and not just visuals. It was written by John Colton and Robert Harris and Harvey Gates. John Colton did the screenplay. Harris did the story. Gates did the adaption from, I guess, a book or I guess an adaption from the folklore. But there's also
just from the story by Harris.
Yeah.
Because Colton was a playwright. This was one of his first ever screenplays.
Okay.
He was actually a playwright. So,
very cool.
Which happens when in our research, we've kind of shown that in the 30s and 40s, they did kind of rely a lot. Remember Bad Seed, which we did just recently,
mm-hmm.
was based on a play as well. The original Dracula was based on the play.
Correct.
So yeah. They tend to have taken from theater a lot more than I ever imagined.
And this is very theatrical, and some of the dialogue is a little ridiculous. And I think it's very funny that the werewolf, at least in The Wolfman, he's running around in tattered clothing. In this one, he's kind of well-dressed, like in that picture behind me with the hat.
Well, yeah, one of my watch notes is exactly that. So he transforms into a beast and takes the time to put on a scarf, a hat, and a jacket. So, yeah, sure. Sure he does. He is in London. He has to look the part.
Right, right. Before we get into a little bit more production, what are your memories, your first impressions of this film or whatever?
This is my first impression. I had never seen this film before.
Oh, wow. I'm shocked.
This was the first time I had watched it. And it was interesting because by the end of it, I really ended up liking it. But there were parts in that middle section where I was going, oh, my gosh, just get on with it. And either attack somebody, kill somebody, do something. Because there's a lot of societal presence in that whole middle section.
Well, and Glendon's kind of a twat.
Well, and I, from what I gather in production, that seemed to be part of
Henry
the actor
Hall.
As well.
Yeah, yeah, Henry Hall's played him.
I do kind of like the misdirect of having two werewolves in one movie. That was kind of interesting. Although we kind of don't know what happens with Megami and why he just suddenly is not there anymore,
right.
Sort of thing at the end. But I did not like the makeup. And I was excited about it because it said Jack Pierce in the opening crawl. And I thought, okay, he did the Wolfman, so this will be cool. And it wasn't until I did research that I found out why. But the makeup is not very effective in this. The scares are
It's because Henry Hall didn't want his face covered up. He's an actor. But he also is a plot element where you're supposed to recognize him as the creature. And that was his argument for lessening the makeup.
Yes, be able to see the creature under the makeup.
To identify the creature as Glendon. Yes, exactly.
But overall, this is one of those, and it's, I especially like the fact that you paired it with our second feature today, because I really liked watching them both back to back.
Me too.
Because I watched them within like an hour of each other. And it was very interesting to see the how does society react to a monster among them sort of thing, and how at different times in history. So,
As far as my history with this movie, I am fairly certain I saw this on Shock Theater as a kid. Because I used to watch all those Universal movies as a kid when they would, on Friday nights from like 11 o'clock till dawn, they would show Son of Frankenstein, Dracula's Daughter, Werewolf of London, you name it. And I watched all those things when I was 7 or 8 years old, pretty young. I have an affinity, you know, as you know, I recently went to Epic Universe and I love Universal monsters. I always have. And I appreciate this film for its place in Universal's pantheon of monster films, because it was originally supposed to be a Boris Karloff Bela Lugosi project. Karloff was going to play Glendon and Yagami was going to play Lugosi was going to play Yagami. But they were making Bride of Frankenstein at the exact same time, because they both came out in 1935, and Bride of Frankenstein was a much bigger movie, and they decided to just recast it and not use Lugosi at all, which kind of makes sense. They always did Lugosi dirty. They'd put him in it if Karloff was in it, but if he wasn't, he rarely got a starring role after Dracula.
Well, and they kind of kept some of it, because I got the impression that Yagami was trying to be Lugosi. It kind of felt like it in places.
Well, it's just funny that you say that, and we'll get into it in casting, but it's the actor you're talking about, really.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But even in writing, they kept like the University of Carpathia, and I'm going, oh, wow, that's Dracula.
and even more steeped in the lore of Universal Pictures is what you mentioned, that Jack Pierce did do the makeup. He's the one that gave us Frankenstein and the Wolfman and Dracula.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not sure about Dracula, but definitely Frankenstein and the Wolfman.
Oh, he did Dracula too, because he did the Widow's Peak. That was his big deal.
Oh, okay.
All the monsters have Widow's Peaks.
So a lot of history there. And I think some people for a while may have viewed this as a failure because the Wolfman came out so strong. But in retrospect, I don't see this as a failure at all. There is a lot in this movie that still resonates today, and especially with our podcast, as far as talking about influence, because there's a lot of influence in this movie as well.
Oh, yeah. I've got the list of tropes, like stuff like the bite leads to infection, transformation always occurs in the full moon, you're battling the civilized side of yourself, very Jekyll Hyde kind of thing. So, yeah, all of that, you wouldn't have a Wolfman with unless they had hinted at it here.
No, and I like the stuff with the flower, too. I just think it shouldn't have been such a major plot point. Because clearly it's temporary. It's not a cure. So what are you going to do when you run out of that third blossom that they're
over? His overall research was how do I keep more – why do I make more blossoms? How do I keep this growing?
Yeah.
So that's why true. I have this really cool moonlight lamp I invented.
Any scenes stand out to you?
A lot of them. From the very beginning, as soon as it went to the first scene and they were at Vasquez Rocks, which is a big Star Trek background from original series, and I've actually visited before, and I was going, yes, that's cool. I love Vasquez Rocks. Even though all of the werewolf attacks in this movie are terrible. The choreography is bad. The filming is bad. They're just like, let's just wrestle for a bit. And then
it actually looks like Kirk and somebody fighting when they're wrestling. Yeah.
Well, there's that. Yeah. I did like all of the Moonlight Lab experiment with his assistant, and it had a very cool mad scientist feel to it. So I liked both of those scenes. I thought they did the first transition well, not the hand transition, but his first.
I love the first transition because it's all done in movement when he is moving and he gets more and more transformed as he passes things that block our vision. So you can't really see the cuts, even though you can. But
and I liked the phone call montage when they're trying to find him. And it's going back from between her and the policeman and the detective and then Yagami and everybody's going back. Where is he? Where is he? Where's Pierce? Kind of thing. Which, or Glendon, which was really cool.
Yeah.
And then my last one for scenes is, of course, that ending. To have a werewolf say a line like, thanks for the bullet. That's just really, that's cool.
Yeah, it is. Other scenes that stand out to me, maybe not for good reasons, are when he goes to the old house or whatever and has the guy lock him up to protect people. When he jumps out of that window because he sees his bride just happens to come there, which is kind of stupid.
Oh, yeah.
But it cuts away from him, then it cuts and he's jumping out of a barred window. And I'm like, they never showed him bend those bars. He just
showed him grab them and twist, and it just like turned into dust. Those bars are totally useless.
Yeah. Okay, well, maybe the version I saw didn't have that, but I just remember them cutting away, then cutting back, and the bars are bent. And I was like, "Wait a minute, how did he get out of that?" And that's why he was going there, so that he couldn't get out.
Right. And one of my watch notes is: you neglect your wife, she's going to hook up with her ex. It's just going to happen. So you just got to be careful.
And then I also like the scene where he lets the wolf out at the zoo. I thought it was really cool to have a wolf man observing wolves in cages.
Yeah, but my note is, so he's a monster, but he knows how to open wolf cages.
Yes. Well, that's that's one of the big things that doesn't make sense in this movie, is that he is more of a wolf man than a werewolf, because he does keep a lot of his man, or his homo sapiens, I guess.
Yeah, that's a really cool. Yeah, that's a really cool point, especially compared to the next one we watch, sort of thing we're doing. I also have in my notes, so he can only kill prostitutes and mistresses. What?
That's very Jack the Ripper, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's a good key, actually.
I agree with you. Although it's very. To me, one of the big keys I have is Invisible Man, because he goes and finds the humorous landladies to lock him up so that he won't hurt anyone, or so he can do his experiments, the Invisible Man. But and then they gossip about him the whole time.
I thought they were so much better, though, than the woman that's in Invisible Man.
Definitely.
She drove you crazy.
I hated her.
But these two are much better. James Whale staple. I can't think of her name right now, but she was a James Whale staple. I like these two ladies. They crack me up.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I thought they were good. It was good comic relief.
You happen to have a drop of alcohol? No, I haven't seen it. No, not at all. She's putting it in her dress.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I can move on to cast. We don't have any more scenes, and we're not going to know a lot of these people, but I do have a little bit. We have Henry Hall, who played Dr. Glendon. He's most known for the movies Lifeboat and High Sierra, which were two, once, I believe, Humphrey Bogart, Hitchcock. The others, Alfred Hitchcock. Yeah, exactly. He was much more of a Broadway stage actor. His greatest success as an actor on Broadway was Erskine Caldwell's Jeter in Tobacco Road.
Ooh, okay.
And it still ranks as the longest running drama in the Great White Way's history, opening in 1933 and closing in 1941 with 3,182 performances.
Wow.
That's longer than a Chorus Line. That's crazy. Chorus Line was like 11 years, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Something like that. Anyway. As I mentioned originally, Boris Karloff was scheduled to play the role, as was Bela Lugosi with Yogami. The roles went to, obviously, Henry Hall, and up next, Werner Olin, who plays Yogami. Olin made the transition from silent films to sound pictures in the late 20s, and he co-starred in Warner Brothers' groundbreaking talkie, The Jazz Singer, the Al Jolson movie from 1927. Then he began landing more prominent roles. Do you know what they are?
No.
Charlie Chan. He played Charlie Chan like 15 times. That's what he's known for. And they used to cast, Karloff and Lugosi as Asians in movies. And this guy's not Asian at all. He's Swedish. So I don't know what kind of racism that is, but it's obviously something where they probably should have cast an Asian man as Charlie Chan.
Probably.
But anyway, he played Charlie. That's what he's known for mostly. And I may have in my notes something elsewhere. I don't have it in front of me right now. I thought I had other roles he played. Valerie Hobson plays Lisa Glendon, the wife of Henry Hall. We last saw her as Elizabeth in Bride of Frankenstein. She did both movies that year. Although, of course, she had small roles in both, so she could probably have more time. Although they play husband and wife in this film, Henry Hall is 27 years older than her. And I think I remember us talking about how she was 17, maybe, when she made Bride of Frankenstein.
Yep.
Yeah, she was. I do have that in my notes. And then we have some others. Lester Matthews plays Paul Ames. Lawrence Grant played Sir Thomas Forsyth. Lawrence Grant, you may have recognized as the Burgermeister in Son of Frankenstein, another Universal movie.
Okay.
And then Spring Byington played Miss Eddie Coombs. Now, I guess that's one of the old ladies.
Yes, I would think so.
Okay. Well, she was gay. I did not know that. She was a longtime companion of actress Marjorie Maine.
She may have been the woman that always gets hysterical, that has all the parties. You know what I mean? The socialite. I think that's her.
Okay.
Etta Coombs. She's the one that was always got hysterical about,
I think you're right, because this woman doesn't look as old as those ladies that are the comedic relief. And I don't have them in my cast notes. So, yeah, I bet you're right. This is a more prominent role. Anyway, she was longtime companion of Marjorie Maine, another actress in Hollywood. A number of historians have claimed that she was a lesbian. Marjorie Maine's biographer has noted that they were reportedly widely as having a long-term relationship. And when asked about her sexual orientation, Maine observed, "It's true. She just didn't have much use for men."
There you go.
Which I found interesting. As far as awards, there really are none because it's not going to get it's way too early for awards in Hollywood. But as far as posthumous awards, in 2017, the Saturn Awards gave it a Best Blu-ray DVD collection as part of the Wolfman Complete Legacy collection, which I own and which is what I watched this movie on. And it is not on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list. I don't have that in my notes, but I'm fairly certain that's true.
I have a casting thing you didn't mention.
Sorry.
One of the old ladies in it is, she's Mrs. So-and-so. Whack is her name. Mrs. Whack, Whack. That's Ethel Griffies. Ethel Griffies is in The Birds. She's the old lady that talks about the scientific basis of the birds in the diner.
That's the same lady?
Mm-hmm.
Because she seems much skinnier in The Birds. Okay.
Well, I guess she's much older. According to the research that I did, she actually started her stage career on the London stage at age 3.
Wow.
And yes, she was in The Birds. She was in a couple of other Alfred Hitchcocks. He liked her, obviously. But yeah, she was Mrs. Whack. And then the other lady, I looked her up. She is Zeffie Tilbury. She is Miss Moncaster, Mrs. Moncaster. And she was in The Grapes of Wrath, the movie.
Okay, I watched that last year.
Yep.
I don't remember what she must have been the matriarch is what I'm thinking. But okay.
Probably. But yeah. But that's the only casting I had other than what you had already said. So, yeah.
Okay.
It's interesting because that's one of my favorite characters in the birds. I love the way there are 467,000 species of birds in the United States.
I know. I just edited a promo for one of our shows coming up where you are actually doing the same thing you just did. You're quoting her. That's very funny.
So, yeah. But, yeah, I thought it was very interesting that she did both. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, before we move on to Keys, do you have any trivia? I've got a bit.
The only bits I had were, first of all, that Pierce did the makeup and he had to pull back because of Hull and what he said, because it was basically a vanity project, so to speak. But he was supported by Carl Limley, who was the producer for this. And didn't he also produce a lot of Universals?
Yeah. You have had to pronounce his name for me before because I couldn't. It's a weird spelling. Limley?
Yeah, it's Limley. L-E-H-M-L-E-Y. Yeah.
Okay.
But he did, I know, Creature from the Black Lagoon, and I think he did Wolfman as well.
Yeah, I think he's done several of the older monster movies that we've covered.
Yeah.
Universal in particular. I had that note that you have on Jack Pierce as well. It's actually quite a long thing. I'm not going to read it, about how he was disappointed because he had to cut back and Henry Hull wanted him to cut back so that his face could be seen, but that he finally had his say when he did the 1941 version with Lon Chaney Jr. and did that classic makeup look.
Okay.
But I do like the look of this werewolf, especially that picture behind me. It's got the really prominent widow's peak, but it's still scary looking. I love how they do a lot of close-ups of the makeup in this, too, where he goes right at the camera. That would terrify me as a kid.
So. And giving him the pointed ears and giving him the lower fangs, I think works really well.
Yeah, the underbite. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was bad. It's just Wolfman is so much better.
Yeah, and the Wolfman has an underbite too. So,
yeah.
Other trivia I've got that the copyright record synopsis has a scene where a boy is almost eaten by a plant in the botanical garden sequence, but is saved by Wilford. And it is not in the final print. Now, I don't know if you recall, but there is a frog eaten by a very nasty-looking octopus plant in this that makes one of the women say she's going to ERP or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's the lady you mentioned. That's the socialite lady.
Coombs. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then, oddly enough, the concept of a werewolf changing in the light of a full moon was dropped in Universal's next film, The Wolfman, only to be revived in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. So that's what I said. They drop things left and right as far as lore.
Yeah, to make it work for the whatever horror movie they're telling at the time. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, it's like you said, it's like what they're doing now or have been doing now with vampires of sometimes it's holy water, sometimes it's sunlight, sometimes they sparkle. People change the lore depending on what works for their story.
Right. And if you consider Sinners an example, that new movie that came out that got such notice, Garlic, and being invited in plays prominently in that movie as well.
Right. So, add what you want sort of thing.
Yeah. Keys?
My first key, of course, is even inspired by the very end, because I've even got in my watch notes, what is with that last shot? Because they cut to the, thanks for the bullet, I'm sorry I couldn't make you happier sort of denouement climax. And then suddenly we cut and it's an aerial shot and we're watching a plane fly. And then we go right into the end credits.
It was very strange.
Why is that an homage? And obviously, that's an homage to Universal. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what they were trying to set up, maybe, is like a final shot plays into Universal somehow or whatever.
Like to me, this movie has to be 45 seconds longer. What can we put in there?
Maybe.
It was so stupid. I was like, why are they ending with that? Yeah, it's very weird.
But so my first key is really Universal and what it did for the monster movie in general. I don't think we would have half the amount of great horror material we have now if Universal had never put the money and the investment and time into these classic monsters.
Yeah, for sure. I have speaking, I think this is Universal. Actually, it may not be Universal. I have Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. Because especially the whole scientist thing and him turning and becoming another person. Basically.
Well, and him battling himself, battling society, mm-hmm. wanting to put himself, lock himself away so he won't hurt someone. Mm-hmm. That's so trope of Jekyll and Hyde.
Right.
So,
yeah. And we've never covered Jekyll and Hyde. We probably need to do one of those because there's several out there.
Well, and mine goes in with that, which is the Invisible Man, mm-hmm. even down to the Invisible Man wanting to play the people that his landladies as the comic relief.
Right.
Sort of thing, which they do in both movies. Mm-hmm. I've got Tarantula or The Fly, that whole feeling of the mad scientist with his private lab that he can flip one little switch on and locks it forever and he lets nobody in, even his wife, all the time. It's always like, don't go in here. No, I'll be in here for days. Just put my food at the foot of the door, you know. Mm-hmm. And you're like, that's no way to have a good marriage. That's not going to be successful.
No, it's so, like you're married to your work, not your wife. I have, and I think I told you this yesterday, I wanted to find out where – I know where Frankenstein comes from. I know where Dracula comes from. Where did werewolves come from? And I looked it up, and they came from Greek mythology. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
Yes, there was a king named Lycan. That pissed Zeus off, and Zeus turned him into a wolf man.
Wow.
And I had no idea that's where it came from. And then it's been adapted, as we say, they pick up lore or lose lore all along the way in different things like Gilgamesh and all these other different cultures' interpretations of the myth.
Yeah.
But it originated in Greek mythology. So Greek mythology is my key.
That's a great key. I did not know that at all. That's
King
really
Lycan.
Cool.
That's where lycanthropy comes from.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
I've got Nosferatu. There's that one attack where he's in the foreground and it shows his shadow, and his shadow is the thing that goes and attacks.
Yeah.
So it's a very Nosferatu sort of shot.
Very cat people as well.
Yep.
Yeah.
Very cat people.
I have Warren Zevon. Werewolves of London. That song played so much on the radio that I used to hate it. It played so much. I used to drive
Yeah, between
crazy.
That and Monster Mash, they were overplayed.
But Warren's was much later. Monster Mash was like the 60s. Warren's was the late 70s. But in researching Warren Zevon's song, I found out there's another folk musician from England that writes lots of songs about Universal Monsters, including an album called The Werewolf of London, and his name is Paul Rowland.
Mm.
So it was just an accidental discovery on my part. I'm not saying he's great, I'm just saying he writes songs about monsters.
Well, and I'm not sure if this movie started the trope or the key, or if it came before it just slightly by a few years or whatever, but this whole scoring technique of every time you see the creature, you have to have trumpet stings. So every time they would show him, you would hear dun 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 kind of thing in the soundtrack. And they use it in Creature from the Black Lagoon, they use it in Wolfman, they use it in Invisible Man.
Yeah. So the music's not that great in this movie.
No, the score is not very strong.
It's like they're trying to score a regular movie instead of a horror movie, and then, like you said, throw those stings in there.
Yeah, and playing with they still feel like they're doing a play, mm-hmm. almost like we said when we did Bad Seed, that there's a lot of talking.
Room.
There's a lot of single room scenes. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of massive exposition dumps. Yeah. And stuff where we explain over and over again. This is Professor Yagami. Yeah, I know that. We already know that.
Mm-hmm. So. There's no way we could list all the werewolf movies there are, which would definitely be keys. So I just put Wolfman, American Werewolf, and The Howling in there.
Well, even down to the new one, Eggers is doing a werewolf movie.
Okay.
So,
very good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then do I have anything else? You said Invisible Man. Oh, I said Jack the Ripper earlier because you mentioned that he attacks prostitutes.
Yeah. Oh, and I also have asked him, isn't there a werewolf X-Files episode? I know there's a chupacabra, but isn't there a werewolf one?
I don't remember one. Huh. But it could be maybe a later one, and I don't remember the later episodes as well as I do the earlier ones.
So maybe
I mentioned in my keys, I have Vasquez Rocks, the whole Star Trek connection.
Of course, yeah.
And then folklore, blah, blah, blah. I guess my mythology comment covers this, but I had copied and pasted something in here about folklore and mythology. Okay. So, okay. I guess that's going to end it for the first half of this segment. So if you want, yes, you can go color again.
Oh, I can go to color. Yay. Change my
because
thing.
Yeah. The next movie is not a black and white movie. The next movie is 1981's American Werewolf in London.
Yes.
You saw me standing alone.
And in this movie, this is a vastly different movie, and it is sort of a comedy horror hybrid, but it's one that I like. It is not one of the ones that irritates me like the modern ones that are going on right now.
Yeah.
This movie, well, the plot is you've got, is it Jack and, what are the guys' names? Jack and David.
Mm-hmm.
Are basically backpacking through Europe, and they happen to be in England, and they are attacked. Well, first they go to a pub, and it's mm-hmm. a pub called the Slaughtered Lamb. It's a great scene with yes. lots of character actors that are very, very good in it, and they end up pissing the people of the pub off because Jack asks about a pentagram that happens to be on the wall, which is a very funny scene, and they end up getting kicked out, much to the reluctance of the barmaid, who says, no, you shouldn't do this because it's dangerous out there. And as they're walking, it gets dark and scary, and they're attacked by a werewolf. Jack is completely eviscerated, pretty much, and David hears a shot, and the people of the pub have come out and shot the beast that attacked him. And before he blacks out, he turns and looks, and it's not a beast at all. It's a naked man that's dead next to him.
Mm-hmm.
So he wakes up 3 weeks later. I thought that was weird that it's 3 weeks go by that he is unconscious.
Well, we only have to give him a week to deal with the full moon coming.
Right, right. And yeah, that's true. Maybe they did it for timing purposes. But he ends up falling for a very nice and pretty nurse that is helping him back to health. They question his sanity because all of a sudden he starts seeing his dead friend Jack that's telling him you're going to turn into a werewolf and you need to kill yourself so that you can sever the line and I can move on to greener pastures. And not greener skin.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically, we have a couple of nights of the full moon where he does one of the most famous movie transformations still in history. And eventually he is killed by, well, he's not killed by his love, but he's cornered by his love. The nerds, because he does admit to her that he loves her at one point, even though all this happens very fast, and he is shot and dies, and that's the end.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very quick movie, actually, as far as timing. It takes place in less than a month. Really, the 3 weeks that go by, you don't even see. So,
right. Yeah, it's a quick timeline, and also not a very long movie itself. Yeah.
No, it's not. But a lot of history to this movie. Mm-hmm. What is your history with this movie?
I watched this movie when it came out. I can't remember if I saw it at a theater, but I definitely saw it several times in the 80s. I've always liked this movie. I've always liked the writing, the pacing. I think it is a movie to exemplify the perfect mix of scary and funny.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we talked recently, last week or week before, about neither one of us really like a mix in our genres as far as comedy mixing into the genre, Galaxy Quest being a really good exception, sci-fi, and Shaun being an exception horror-wise.
Right.
I think this one works for horror as well. It has some really funny kind of humorous scenes to it, but also some really great scares.
It is clear that the horror outweighs the humor in this.
Yes.
And I think that's where I like my horror comedies to fall. I still want it to be a horror movie with comedic elements, not a comedy with horror elements.
Perfectly said. Yep. I agree with you. But yeah, so I remember quoting it. I remember being at parties and quoting, "A naked American man stole my balloons." It's a great line.
Yeah.
And stick to the roads and stay off the moors. Uh-oh. Look
around. Right.
So, yeah.
My history, I think I saw this movie in a theater. Is it?
I think I did too. I'm not sure if it was in 81, but I think I did. Yeah.
Is it rated R?
I'm sure it was.
Well, I would have been 15 in 80. So I would have only been 16 in 81. So that means I might not have, because I would have had to have been 17 back then.
But you might have seen a re-release if it came out a few years later.
Maybe. I definitely watched it on videotape, and I watched it several times on videotape in the 80s. But this is the first time I've seen this movie in over 30 years.
Easy. Oh, wow. Well, I have probably, probably 20 years, at least, I would think.
And I was pleasantly surprised, because I got kind of tired of it in the 80s. And now to revisit it, I was like, I can't believe I'm rediscovering this movie, because it is really, really good.
Yeah, my scenes, I've got like 8 scenes from this. Yeah. It's just great. And the chemistry between the two of them is, Landis just lit on, not only between David and Jack, but also David and her.
And her.
That's great
Jenny
chemistry.
The
doctor is a great character. Mm-hmm. So Landis really lucked out with this one. So...
Well, he did.
Very interesting.
And I think that one of the reasons it has some charm is because most of the cast is British. I think that's cool, that it is a literal American Werewolf in London. He is American. Jack's American, but he's dead. And really, everyone else is British.
Mm-hmm.
I find that there's some charm in that to me. I find charm in it anyway. Scenes? Or do you have any more? You want to do some more production? We may have a little bit of production, actually, before we should move on to scenes. Oh, we need to talk about John Landis, obviously.
Well, yeah, John Landis coming into this. He's working with Guber and Peters, and Folsey Jr., who did most of his movies. That was a producing team that kind of – and if you look up Guber and Peters and the 80s, it's like every other movie release they produced.
Yeah, I think Barbara Streisand even dated one of them, maybe.
In every genre you can imagine. They did comedies, they did dramas, they did action, they did Tango and Cash. They just did everything. Mm-hmm. They were like these huge producers in the 80s.
And I think it started in the 70s, actually.
Probably. Yeah. I would think it might have. They just got huge, not pedigree, but they've got huge clout, I guess, for lack of any other thing. Landis, however, falls into that category that I've always thought of almost like, Dan O'Bannon and John Carpenter early on, where right out of the gate, they're doing stuff that's pretty incredible and remarkable.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Well, he came from a comedic background, though. He did.
Well, yeah, because
Kentucky
he
Fried
did
movie.
Schlock and then Kentucky Fried Movie, which most people don't even know about, but is so much fun.
It's
it is
crazy.
Just a funny freaking movie.
Yeah, but then he did Animal House, which was huge. Yeah. And he did The Blues Brothers. He considers American Werewolf the crown jewel in his career. But a lot of people would probably consider Thriller, the music video he did for Michael Jackson, a crown jewel as well. That's a very memorable video, a very well thought of video.
But that's a huge key, because he actually got that job because of this movie.
Because of this movie, yeah. Because a werewolf for Michael Jackson.
Well, yeah, they wanted a werewolf, and Michael Jackson wanted the best werewolf he could possibly be. So he hired him and Rick Baker to do that video.
Yeah.
So, of course.
Yeah. And then we've talked in the past, we won't dwell on it, about how in 1983 he went on to do Twilight Zone, the movie with Spielberg and Joe Dante and others. And there was a horrible set accident where Vic Morrow and two kids were killed from a helicopter crash. And he never really overcame that. He even says he lives with it every day of his life. I read that in my notes.
Well, he did, his career did rebound. So he came back with some stuff. Coming to America is a good
Trading Places, maybe?
Did he Trading Places. Okay. He did Beverly Hills Cop.
No, he didn't do Beverly Hills Cop.
He did three. He did the third.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, he didn't do the original, I don't think.
He did the reboot of Blues Brothers in 2000.
Yeah, so these are all, yeah, they're not the clout he should have been getting, really. From what his track record was.
It's amazing that he got to do anything after the accident. But because he wasn't found criminally responsible, but it was highly believed that he contributed to the death of those people.
Yeah, he unfortunately should have had at least stunt people in there, but they would have died too. Yeah.
Yeah, either way, there would have been death just because of the protocols that were done. And it led to a bunch of new safety restrictions.
Right. It kind of obscured Twilight Zone, the movie, which was a great movie. But I think it would have been much more or much better received had that accident not happened.
Oh, I totally agree. Yeah. And as far as keys go, that's reverberated down to The Crow, Rust, the one that just happened a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So on-set accidents that were due to some form of negligence.
Right.
So, sad, but because this movie is great. It is one of the best.
It is a standout amongst a million werewolf movies that came out at the time.
Mm-hmm.
1981, The Wolfen, The Howling. 1985, Teen Wolf, Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf, Full Moon High, 1981, Teen Wolf 2, 1987, The Company of Wolves, 1984, and The Howling 3 in 1987. It's like the 80s were the decade of werewolf movies.
And this one has still to this day one of the best transformations ever designed and filmed.
I agree. And I think The Howling is second. To that, probably.
Howling a second.
Yeah.
But that's Rob Bottin. So come on. That's the guy that did The Thing. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that movie's on our list. I'm sure we'll probably come across it someday down the road. Scenes?
The very opening alone is great. Just with the long, long, long shot of the truck coming. And we're hearing, I think the first one is Bad Moon Rising. Mm. Yeah, I hear a bad moon arising.
Right. And, or blue moon or something,
Oh, no, blue moon is the credit, right. That's because I've got, as far as scenes, one of my, quote, scenes that I love about this is the soundtrack for this. The fact that he picked Blue Moon, Bad Moon Rising. There was one other one that he has in the post-credits. So really, and they work for each one. But the pub scene cannot have this movie without the pub scene.
The pub scene's great, and there's lots of great people in that.
Oh, yeah.
But I like what you were talking about in the beginning when they get out of the truck with the sheep.
Oh, yeah.
The humor
starts there. And they say goodbye
there.
To the sheep.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
The scene and when you they have leave this great pub. Scene right after that that really, although they're talking about, I want to get in this girl's pants or whatever kind of thing, their camaraderie and their friendship and the dialogue and the chemistry, it just works so well with just them walking along the road, mm-hmm. talking to each other, but it works so well to establish their characters.
Yeah.
So well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because Griffin's almost like the comedic to his straight man. And then he becomes the comedic once Griffin is dead. Or the Jack character is dead. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The scene after they leave the pub, the attack scene, I guess. It's extremely scary. Yes. Very scary.
With the rain and the way it's filmed and the breath.
And they're not showing anything. It's like they're saying it. It's circling us.
Yeah. What is it? Jack, what is that? What the hell is that, David? Come on. It's great.
Yeah.
And then they do the fake fall, or he trips, and then the, oh, here, let me help you up. Then the attack happens.
Just from the side. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so good. We already talked about it, but I've got the transformation is next. That's the, it's so good and so well filmed.
And so long. It's like 2 minutes long.
Well, yeah, because you get to see everything from his hand extending to the way that his legs break the other way. And it makes the transition feel painful again, as opposed to even in the Wolfman doing these lap dissolves of great makeup. Yeah, but we don't sense that that's totally painful.
Right.
Whereas in this, no, changing into the wolf isn't fun at all. I've got the scene right before that, what I call the anticipation montage, where we know as an audience that he is about to change. And Jack has told him he's about to change. But it takes forever. And they're playing Bad Moon Rising as he's like trying to watch television, trying to read, trying to walk around the apartment. We all know it's going to happen any minute.
And it all starts really with him going, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, he screams. Yeah.
I love the porno theater scene, even though that's clearly a robot and not really Griffin Dunn.
Yeah, that makeup doesn't work as effectively, but everybody else, you could shoot yourself or hang.
Yeah. all of that is so Monty Python-esque. It is hilarious to me.
And the scene with anytime you have the two cops together, it's very Monty Python.
Yeah.
Dropping or very the whole Peter plate Sellers. Of stuff in the back. And very homage to Peter Sellers. That's a good key, actually, Peter Sellers.
British humor.
I've also got Jack's first appearance. It's a great scene. The one in the hospital when he's got the neck flap. Because he's eating his toast and eggs, and he's got that little flap of skin because his entire throat is ripped out.
It's just shredded. He looks horrible. It's right. Here's a picture of him right there.
It is so good.
You talk
so
Freddy Krueger, man. That is a pizza face if I've ever seen one.
Yeah. I've got one you might have, which is the nightmare. The Nazi werewolf nightmare.
Which still kind of baffles me. I don't understand really the placement of that. I know he's having weird dreams, but why are there Nazis?
Well, yeah, I don't know why he picked that motif for it. Because other than that, he's running through the woods and killing deer.
Which make more sense, much more sense.
Right, but this is suddenly like, now you burst in and you're killing my entire family.
Right.
Kind of thing. Because evidently Nazi that's regalia. His family. But you're in Nazi werewolves. So yeah, I don't know. It reminded me, if you just took that scene, you could easily add like a comedy joke at the end, but put that scene in Kentucky Fried Movie.
Yeah.
Because it has that weird, disjointed weirdness to it. So, yeah, I agree with you. That must be a Landis thing. I don't think that's a screen. Well, he wrote it. So, yeah, it's a Landis
thing. See You Next Wednesday is definitely a Landis in joke, which is the name of the porno film.
Right. And that's
Go ahead.
That's a joke that's in every one of his movies and in Thriller. That's the movie they're watching in Thriller.
Okay. And I forgot to mention this in production, but he wrote this script in 1969, and no one would make it because they said it was too horrific to be a comedy. So it wasn't until he did movies like Animal House and got the clout that he finally could make this movie. So this movie was in development basically since 1969.
Wow.
Yeah. He wrote it like when he was in school or something. Yeah.
I've got the escalator shot. One of my favorite shots because it's really the first time we see the werewolf.
Yeah.
But it's so well done because we're at the very top of that escalator and the guy's there and we just see it at the top of the frame, crawl into frame, and then we cut. Yeah. So I really liked that.
Yeah. I like the scene, and I had forgotten about this whole section of the movie, but after he is transformed, he has another day with Jenny Ogeter's character, and he's like, I feel great. He's like, let's get something to eat or whatever. Let's have sex. Yeah. Because he's like so energized after being out the night before killing people.
Well, yeah, and it's kind of that commentary on your primal side giving you all this energy and alpha male stuff. Yeah,
right, mm-hmm. right, revitalized. Yeah. I thought that was a great scene as well. But any scene with him and Auguder, they just have great chemistry.
Excellent. She does anyway. She's just so good at conveying when she first gets interested in him and then how she's more interested in him and then she's mm-hmm. falling in love with him. So it's really mm-hmm. good. And I mentioned it before, but this movie, to me, it will always be known as A Naked American Man Stole My Balloon.
I love that whole scene because he's behind the bush and he's like, hey, kid, come over here.
Hey, kid, come here.
And you're like, that kid's not going to go over there. Are you crazy? I'll give you a pound. 2 pounds.
I'll give you a pound for your balloons.
Yeah, funny stuff.
Well, and scenes, maybe not good scenes. I really dislike the fact that this movie has no denouement at all.
It just ends.
Not even a thanks for the bullet or I love you or something, anything. It's just naked body and credits.
Right.
We're done.
Right.
And we're going to allow this woman to walk down this alley while we have it blockaded off with police. Yeah,
not to mention not shoot her when they're shooting from behind her. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
That's a good shot.
The very last scene is a little problematic for me in this movie, but everything else I think
works. Yeah, and the actual werewolf itself, it's best shown in fast glimpses because sometimes when you look at it whole for a long time, it looks too fake. It looks like Fluffy from Creepshow or Michael Jackson from Thriller.
Yeah, it's very big. Mm-hmm. It's a very big werewolf as opposed to like the Howling in Bottin's version, which is very sinewy, like a wolf. It's mm-hmm. very, its legs are very thin and small. And this one, it's got like, it's a bodybuilder werewolf.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely got some testosterone going.
Yeah.
Any more scenes before we move on? I can go on to cast. Nope. Well, the lead is David Naughton. He played David Kessler, as we mentioned. He is most known, of course, for the Dr. Pepper ads that we grew up with. Wouldn't you like to be a Pepper too? He was the guy singing and dancing in those commercials. He was let go by Dr. Pepper because of the nude scenes in this movie.
Interesting. I did not know that.
I can't remember what the percentage is, but he is naked a lot in this movie. He is running around naked.
In the woods. Yep.
In the woods. Naked. And it's full frontal and everything. It's brief, but you see everything. And I was like, there's a lot of male nudity in this movie for 1981.
For 1981, he got away with a lot. Yep.
Yeah. I guess because it was a horror movie. He had a disco song that was a big hit in 1979 called Making It.
I did not know that.
I'm making it. Da, 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 I'm making it. You don't remember that song?
Not at all. I repressed it, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. It was used in the movie Meatballs with Bill Murray.
Huh. Okay.
Someone else was considered for this role that was very popular at the time and makes perfect sense when you think about it, but I don't think he would have been as good.
Who?
Michael Beck.
Michael who? Beck?
Yeah.
No, he wouldn't have had the charm. Beck doesn't have the charm that Naughton has.
Yeah.
I don't
I don't think he had the charm either because the charm comes from those Dr. Pepper commercials. But Landis had seen him in Warriors, which was 1979, but PolyGram wouldn't allow him to be cast because of the failure of Xanadu. So that's why he's not in it.
I think that would have been a really bad mistake.
I think so, too. I don't think he has the comic chops that David Naughton had. Yeah.
And I don't think he has that. Naughton just has this kind of everyman sort of feel to him in all these scenes with Jack. And it works so well that, and even when he's with her, the way he interacts with the doctor, the way he interacts with the cop, Beck would have had an edge to him, I think, that wouldn't have worked in my
Beck's a tough guy looking, even though he did Xanadu. Maybe that's why Xanadu didn't do well. But you wonder what the irony is?
No.
David Naughton and Griffin Dunne both auditioned for the Beck role in Xanadu.
Well, there you go. That's some irony, definitely.
Yeah, that is irony. Griffin Dunne, as we mentioned, plays Jack Goodman. I mean, I don't have enough. I can't think of I've got so many good things I could say about him. I don't even know where to begin. He's great. He reminds me of other comedic actors of his time. He reminds me a little bit of Peter Scolari from Bosom Buddies.
I could see that.
Yeah, he's just a great actor. He comes from not a hierarchy. He comes from a pedigree of people. His dad was Dominic Dunn, a producer, an actor, a writer. He was the oldest child of Dominic Dunn. He was best friends with Carrie Fisher. I don't know if you knew that or not. But he is still acting today. I mean, you can go back and watch the last season of Only Murders in the Building. He's in it. He's got a prominent part in it. Yeah.
I recognized him the second episode of This Is Us and went, oh my gosh. And he's great in that entire series.
Yeah. He's still working. So.
Yeah. He has over 100 credits on IMDb. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, because he doesn't always play lead roles. He's comfortable playing secondaries. I think that's part of
it. Good at it. Mm-hmm. Good at it. Just that a very Gene Hackman kind of approach to great character work that is just excellent. You just like it.
Agreed. Yeah. David Schofield is one of those recognizable faces in the pub. He is the dart thrower that eventually tells the doctor what might be happening. He was in Gladiator. He was also in Pirates of the Caribbean. He's just a prominent British actor with a very familiar face. Especially if you saw him now, you go, oh, yeah, I know who that guy is. Brian Glover plays one of the chess players. He was in Alien 3, and I note in my picture that he's bald, so maybe that's why.
He's still too heavy. That's one of my Yeah. Nothing like a good racist joke in your pub to really work.
Lila Kay plays the barmaid. She is the one sympathetic character, really, in the bar that doesn't want to send the boys out into the full moon night.
Yes.
But probably my favorite of the people that are in the pub is the second chess player, who is played by Rick Mayall of The Young Ones.
And it took me like the third shot of him when the chess player glares at him and says, don't say anything. And he looks back and I went, oh, my God, is that the Young Ones guy? And I had to look it up. I didn't recognize him.
So, my notes say he's Prick in The Young Ones because that's what Vivian called him. Instead of Rick, he called him Prick.
Nick.
But he was also in a movie called Drop Dead Fred that got some cult status, I do believe. As a brief history, frequently performed alongside Adrian Edmondson, who played Vivian. They were all members of like the comic strip troupe. Rick and his friends, including Jennifer Saunders, Adrian Edmondson's husband, Dawn French, Alexi Sale, Peter Richardson, and Nigel Planner, were all boomed onto screens with immense success when he did The Young Ones with Ben Elton and Lisa Mayer. You either loved it or hated it, but you cannot deny the impact it had on British television sitcoms. So I think that's cool because they only did like 12 episodes, maybe 13, and that's it. There's only one season of that show, and I still love it.
Yeah.
Jenny Ogutter plays Alex, the love interest. She's the nurse. Yep. I don't know a lot about Jenny Ogutter, but the reason she's familiar to me is because I knew you had hot pants for her when we did Logan's Run.
Yeah, she's good in that too.
And she's running around that short skirt.
Yeah.
And she does a shower scene in this, and I will say it is not a convincing scene. She's just kind of nibbling on his shoulder, and I'm like, doesn't look real sexy to me.
That happens. You can't. What? Nothing wrong with that. Little shoulder nibbling is not bad.
Yeah, it looks to me like she's comfortable to be uncomfortable being naked. But
yeah.
And I did read where like all the crew showed up that day because they knew that shower scene was happening, which was kind of a
the bedroom scene, the sex scene. It's pretty. They're both obviously naked. So.
But she's great. I don't know. Is she like Griffin Dunn, just doing more character work? Because I'm sure she's still working too.
Yeah. Just done the character stuff.
Yeah. And probably British stuff that we don't see. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Dr. Hirsch is played by John Woodvine,
who has a huge resume.
Yes.
He's in everything.
He is. And guess what else?
What?
He is the father of Mary Woodvine, who was in my genre week topic, Ennisman.
Oh.
Ennisman. That's my segue connection to this film.
Interesting.
Yeah. I was like, who is this old woman in this movie that's driving me crazy? And then I watch American Werewolf of London, her father plays the doctor in it.
Actually, he's in it. According to IMDb, he's the preacher in it.
He could be. Oh, really? Because I didn't think he would be still alive, but I don't know.
It's his last role. He actually died in October of 25.
Well, there you go. So he just, and like I said, it's predominantly a solo performance by her, but there are like some hallucination type things where you briefly see other people. So he must have been one of those other people.
Yeah.
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 Other people that are of note, well, I just have one really, and it's Frank Oz, who voices Yoda and Miss Piggy. And of course, there's a scene in this movie where they are watching The Muppet Show.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that the inspector and the other cop wanted this to be their breakout roles. I don't know if they've done stuff since then, but both of them are somewhat memorable for him, sort of thing.
Yeah. As far as awards, this movie won an Oscar for Best Makeup, well-deserved, by Rick Baker.
Won the first Oscar for makeup.
Well, there you go. Because they actually created
the Oscar category for this movie.
What do you think Dick Smith thinks of that?
I know. You think? He looks back and goes, what, The Exorcist? Huh? You guys couldn't do it for that?
And I'm the one that created this guy. And not only was it Rick Baker's first Oscar, he has won 7 total since then. Or, well, in total. It also won a Saturn for Best Horror Film and Makeup. It was nominated for Writing and Actress as well. And it is on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list.
Oh, yeah. It should be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
totally.
It's definitely up there in the classics of horror, especially werewolf movies. So that's what I have as far as cast and awards. Did you have any trivia you want to say before we move on to keys?
The only other trivia I had is the one you mentioned. Well, I have two. One is, it was the first ever Oscar. And for some reason, and I never found out the actual reason, but this was the first film to be allowed to film in Piccadilly Circus in 15 years. They had blocked it totally. And then 15 years later, American Werewolf in London is allowed to film there. So they really did film for an entire week in Piccadilly Circus.
I imagine it's difficult because that's the equivalent of Times Square in New York. It's just very busy. Yeah.
Huge thoroughfare. And I'm sure it's kind of hard since it's a roundabout. It's probably hard to block off too. So,
yeah, not even in the early morning. There's still going to be cars, I would think. Back to what you said about the moon songs. The only other moon song that you didn't mention that I know that's in this is Moon Dance by Van Morrison, which I think comes during like maybe a love montage with Jenny Agutter. I can't remember. But the song that John wanted to secure the rights to the most was the Cat Stevens song Moonshadow. But because the film dealt with supernatural, undead, and werewolves, it became, and because of the graphic violence at the time, Stevens, who had already converted to Islam, as we know, and changed his name to Yusuf, refused the request. So Cat Stevens would not let him use it. I wonder if he would have let him use it now, though, because I think he's got different views now.
Maybe.
That kind of thing. I don't know. But Moonshadow is actually about killing and dismemberment.
And it should have been in here. Yeah. We should figure that out.
Yeah. Landis thought it was perfect for the movie, but Stevens had other ideas. So it was not used. But that would have been a fourth moon song. Because I think there's 3 moon songs in this. The Fogerty one, the Morrison one, and Blue Moon, the song, the classic song, Blue Moon. So he couldn't get Moonshadow. But that's all I have as far as keys. As far as trivia, if you want to move on to keys, or do you have
anything?
Okay.
No, that's all me for trivia too.
Yeah. Well, my first key is Curse of the Werewolf with Oliver Reed, because she mentions it in this movie. She goes, "Is that the one with Oliver Reed?" And he's right. There's also the Universal one.
He's also mentioning the Lon Chaney Jr. one, which is Wolfman. Right. So, of course, it's got to be in there, too.
Right.
And I also have another key to me, which is very universal, which is the pub of people giving us all the exposition. So that's in Dracula, that's in this, that's in Invisible Man. So that whole
definitely pubs play prominently, especially in European films, settings. Yeah.
And it's also in, you probably don't know it, but it's also in the Black Mirror episode about the werewolf. Starts out with a big pub scene where they're giving the history of the town.
Interesting.
Sort of. So, yeah.
The Black Mirror sci-fi werewolf.
Yeah, should never have been an episode of Black Mirror, but hey, sure. Why not? Yeah.
Most of the keys basically carry over from Werewolf of London, so I don't really have many to add to the ones that we did from Werewolf of London. But one in particular that I will add, just because it reminds me of it for some reason, is the movie Dog Soldiers from Neil Marshall. Yeah. It reminds me of that scene with the Nazi werewolves busting in on that family, because about soldiers.
They're soldiers, yeah. Mm-hmm. Really good werewolf movie.
Yeah, Neil Marshall went on to direct The Descent, which is another great movie that we've already covered on this podcast a long time ago.
What's the other werewolf movie with the girl? Ginger Snaps.
Yeah, I'll put that in
there. That's another one that's pretty good, too, as far as changing the werewolf mythology, so to speak.
It's a cult movie. I watched it for a genre topic, a few years back, and I was not that impressed with it.
I think Dog Soldiers is better and scarier.
Well, I think Neil Marshall's just a great director.
And our friend Steve Roey loves that movie, so I remember that. I have The Evil Dead because of all of his dream sequences where the camera's really low running through the woods. It reminds me of the opening of Evil Dead.
Well, there's a lot of running through the woods, yeah, for sure.
But yeah, a lot of times it's just we're just kind of panning with David. But when it's his POV and he's like jumping over woods and going through trees and all that, it's just very Evil Dead to me.
I have one that I copped from IMDb because I have never seen this movie. But Bryan Singer has said that the scene when Angel transforms into Archangel in X-Men Apocalypse was inspired by this film.
The transformation, maybe? Is there a...
I'm sure.
Oh, my hand is getting big or whatever?
Yeah, I'm absolutely positively sure that's what it is. So I just haven't seen it.
I had mentioned Monty Python, of course, and you had mentioned Peter Sellers,
yeah.
Both those are very... And we said Thriller and Michael Jackson, but also not only for... Oh, I wanted to do a scary video, but that video essentially changed videos forever, giving them more story, giving them more production value. It's not just the band in concert doing a bunch of quick cuts sort of thing. So I think the creativity that came from allowing Landis to work with Jackson on that kind of changed videos forever. So it's absolutely a huge key.
Yep, no argument here on that.
And my only last one is a question, actually, for you.
Sure.
Because this movie has the trope of the double nightmare scare. And I was wondering, is this before? This is after? Help me in timeline. This is after Nightmare on Elm Street, right?
No, before. So,
okay.
Nightmare on Elm Street was 84. This is 81.
So I'm wondering when that trope developed, the whole... Oh my gosh, that was scary. And then suddenly, oh my gosh, that was scary. That double jump nightmare scare.
I don't know. I don't know if Wes Craven did it before then, but Wes Craven made The Hills Have Eyes and a few other movies before Nightmare.
Well, it's become a big trope since then of that being the double scare that we don't expect.
Kind of I don't thing. Know where that originated, but you're right. Huh. Occasionally, I do come across it in movies where it's like, ooh, yeah. scare you. Ooh, scared you again.
yeah. yeah. Got you twice.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. yeah. And it happens. It's when she opens the curtains in the hospital and the Nazi werewolf
stabs her. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So. But yeah, I've really enjoyed both of these. It was good to see one I hadn't seen before and then juxtaposed with this one, which I hadn't seen in a while and really liked.
Which in a way, in a weird way, they are connected. It's clear John Landis was making a play on the title of the original film by of calling course. It An American Werewolf in London because there was a werewolf in London.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But his story tells much more, to me, a personal journey and the pain and everything from it, and creates this whole trope that I don't think anyone's done since of werewolf victims are almost like vampires. Not that they turn into a werewolf, but they are.
Love,
but if you're
love,
killed by the vampire.
That. Yeah, I think that is a very – I'm glad you brought it up because, to me, that is a very unique addition to the lore that I really like.
Yeah. Yeah. If you are killed by the vampire, you are cursed to be like in limbo until that vampire is killed. That
werewolf is killed. you keep saying vampire.
My favorites. Come on. But yeah, if you're attacked by the werewolf and killed, you're cursed until.
Yeah. And Tim gets zombies.
Yeah. And who gradually deteriorate, even turning into puppets.
Yeah. Sort of thing. And they look like that. Like something out of Creepshow.
And I'm wondering if Frank Oz and Jim Henson helped with that at all.
Oh, Baker, I don't know.
With the puppet design for Jack in his last.
Oh, the one that's in the porno theater where it's clearly not real. It looks like something out of Poltergeist. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've always had trouble when you have any form of puppetry or any form of person. Even down to you know me, I bitched about even Walking Dead about how can they moan? They don't breathe. They don't have air. So why would they be able to even speak or make sound or anything? But especially when you turn them into monsters that have no lips and yet they're having this entire conversation.
It doesn't work.
And it's like,
Yeah, I wish they would have just let Rick do more extensive makeup and put Griffin in the seat because it would have been better. Yeah.
Well, it would have really, and I like you said, when you said favorite scenes, I'd forgotten how much I really did like that whole scene because it's everybody. It's the three hobos that he killed,
yeah.
the couple that he killed.
Yeah. And I love the beginning of it when he sees him across the street standing in front of the theater and he's like waving him over. Yeah.
Yeah. Hi, David. I'd like you to meet Mr. So-and-so and Mrs. So-and-so. They're the people you killed.
Yeah. All of this happened because you didn't listen to me.
Yeah.
Basically.
Love it. Come on, David. Yeah. So anyway, that's what Tim and I think about werewolves and growing hair all over your body and going out and killing prostitutes and stuff or not listening to your best dead friend that got killed too. We would love to know what you guys think. So let us know in the comments down below. Did you like it? Did you not like it? Did we miss something, a key, or maybe? We always love to be corrected sometimes. And also, if you're interested and you're new and just joining us, we have plenty of other episodes. You can go to the website, the YouTube channel, everything else. Look up your favorite or least favorite movies, see what we think about them and what we recommend and how they influenced other movies. And if you'd love to support us, we would love for you to do that by joining our Patreon. Of course, we have a Patreon channel. You can look at it. It has some free content, but also has some paid content that we really enjoy, including other podcasts, Star Trek, X-Files, and other stuff that's coming up. So we would love to have you help us do that. Tim, are we scary next time? Are we?
I don't know. Are we? We just did. Well, no, sci-fi.
Oh, sci-fi next time. So, yeah, next time you guys come back. If you're new, join us, Nick, please, next time.
And then we may do a vampire movie. Maybe you'll be happy.
I can say vampire again. Yes, it would always work. But great. But until then, I'll see you then.
All right. Have a good one.
Bye.